All right, let's continue on and look at the next section of the information about Jesus and his arrest and trial and his execution, which we'll talk about more fully next time. We ended the sermon talking about Jesus entering into Jerusalem, being greeted by the crowds with the palm branches and them crying out, Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, King of Israel. And Jesus was and basically in the way that he came into the city, he came in there in a particular way, and people were acknowledging him as the Messiah. And they were acclaiming him in that way, even though he had never said, I am the Messiah. And people were coming to the conclusion that he was the Messiah because there was a cumulative effect of his ministry. All of the preaching, all of the miracles, and all of the things that had played out in his ministry, and then his resurrecting Lazarus from the dead, all of this was an indication that he was the Messiah. And even though he did all of those things, a lot of people weren't aware of him as the Messiah. They wondered. Remember, John the Baptist asked, are you the one, or do we look for another? Even John the Baptist had some doubt about whether he was the Messiah or not. And there had been a lot of speculation, and now with all of the things that had taken place, people are, at least a sizable group of people, are acclaiming him to be the Messiah. And this acclamation wasn't just because of the resurrection of Lazarus. That was a major thing that excited the imagination of the people. But it also had to do with the fact that Jesus was riding into Jerusalem on the colt of an ass. So why did that attract attention? Undoubtedly, lots of people came into the city riding on animals when they would enter the city of Jerusalem. And why should that stand out? Why should it stand that he wasn't the first person to ride into Jerusalem on the colt of an ass? And why should they read anything into that? They could certainly turn to Zechariah, which is a messianic prophecy. In Zechariah chapter 9, verse 9, it says, rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. He is just and having salvation, lowly, riding on a donkey, a colt, the foal of a donkey. And why would you associate Jesus with this rather than somebody else? So the answer is, yes, he could ride into the city on the colt of an ass or on a fully grown horse or other animal. But not when you came to the Passover. And I don't mean just the Passover day, but when you entered Jerusalem as a pilgrim on one of the three pilgrimage festivals, you did not ride. You walked. You didn't ride, you walked. It's just the way you do things. You don't enter the city of Jerusalem riding, you enter by walking. Fulfilling, even if it's only in the last few steps, the literal term of the pilgrimage festivals. If you look at the word that is translated pilgrimage festivals there, where it says, talks about three seasons, they're foot festivals. And they're tied in with your walking up to the feast, to keep the feast. So traditionally, if you rode your donkey all the way to the city of Jerusalem, you would get off your donkey and you would walk in the city the last few steps for the Passover at that season, at Pentecost, and at the fall festivals. You would walk into the city to observe the festivals. So therefore, by choosing to ride in as a pilgrim, it's a very visible statement on his part that, though not made with words, it's a symbolic thing. It is a statement that he is the Messiah. So the people immediately recognized what this symbolized, and they became quite excited, because for a long time, many of them had speculated maybe he is the one. If you look through the the Gospels, you'll see it various times. Maybe this is the one. The way he preaches is not as one would normally preach. And then there's Lazarus's resurrection from the dead. And now he's coming to the, into the city riding on the colt of an ass. And maybe, and they're saying maybe he is the one. So after his interrogation by Annas, once Annas found that he could get nothing out of him, Jesus is not going to review everything that he's done, said, and taught. Then, and we pick up the story in John chapter 18, verse 19. John chapter 18, verse 19, it says, "Then the high priest, that is Annas, asked Jesus about his disciples and his doctrine. And Jesus answered him, 'I spoke openly to the world. I always taught in the synagogue and in the temple, where the Jews always meet. And in secret, I have said nothing. I have said nothing. Why do you ask me? Ask those who have heard me when I said to them, indeed, they know what I said.'" And then, you know, he's seen as being impertinent or disrespectful to the high priest, and he slapped. And then in verse 24 of John 18, it says, "Then Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest." So we move on to the third incident, and that is Jesus being interrogated at the house of Caiaphas, the high priest. So we've had two events so far. First of all, Jesus is arrested. Secondly, he goes to the house of Annas for interrogation. And now he goes to the house of Caiaphas, where they're going to continue his interrogation. So this is a major event, and it has caused a great deal of controversy among scholars. Those who believe in the inspiration of the scriptures believe that these accounts reflect what really took place. But the scholars don't believe that. They believe this is completely fictitious, and that there is no way, because of the rules of the time as far as having trials and all of that, that this never would have happened. But we've never seen any travesties of the law, have we? That never takes place in our time. Yes, it does. So why should we be surprised that they're going to follow the law to the T in their time? But it is interesting, as you look at what unfolds here, how it can be interpreted. So this what we see in it's taking place here at Caiaphas's home is a meeting of what many believe is the Sanhedrin, which is the large body that would adjudicate matters in Judea. That's how it's seen. They're interrogating and judging Jesus, voting on a on what sentence of judgment to pass on him. And it was illegal for the Sanhedrin to meet at night and deliver any judgment. So the question is it the Sanhedrin that is meeting at nighttime with Jesus there? I think we've said that it was, but I think you may see it a little bit differently as we look at it today. And if it is the meeting of the Sanhedrin, this couldn't be historical, scholars say. What we have here is not so much a trial, but an interrogative session. They're asking him questions. It's kind of like a grand jury, a preliminary hearing before the actual trial. And they're seeing if they have enough evidence to proceed. So what's the evidence? Do we have enough evidence to proceed? Now, the outcome we want is to kill him. We want him put to death. But do we have enough evidence to make that, draw that conclusion and put him to death? So it's also interesting to note that who was present at this particular nighttime session. We have to be careful that we don't misconstrue who is present because of the use of certain terms. So let's pick up in Matthew chapter 26, verse 57. Matthew chapter 26, verse 57. It says, "And those who had laid hold of Jesus led him away to Caiaphas the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were assembled." So the scribes and the elders are assembled. So we have to be careful what this means and what it implies. Verse 59. of chapter 26 says, "Now the chief priest and the elders and all the council sought false testimony against Jesus to put him to death." Matthew 26, verse 59 in the Young's literal translation says, "And the chief priest and the elders and all the council were seeking false witness against Jesus that they might put him to death." Their goal is false witnesses by which they can put him to death. That's an important phrase. That's the goal, to put him to death and to find a legal reason for doing so. And to me, let's think about this for a second. It's interesting how the human mind works. You are seeking false witnesses to condemn this guy to death, and you're worried about legalities? Do you see that maybe there's a disconnect? But human nature easily disconnects from what would be right, and you would be pursuing it consistently. They're willing to be inconsistent if they are able to achieve their goal. But it's kind of funny. Okay, you guys are worried about legalities, and you're willing to take false witnesses to condemn this guy, which is condemned in the Scriptures. Oh, well, the end justifies the means. So anyway, their goal is to put him to death. They sought to false witnesses in order to accomplish that purpose. Chapter 26, verse 60 says, "But they found none. Even though many false witnesses came forward, they found none. But at last, two false witnesses came forward and said, 'This fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days.'" So as you look at this, does this mean they sought false witnesses and found none? They didn't find false witnesses, but they did. But what's the problem? We have to go elsewhere to find the answer to this. In all of this interrogation, Jesus holds his peace, as it says in Matthew 26:62. "And the high priest arose and said to him, 'Do you answer nothing? What is it these men testify against you?' But Jesus kept silent." So Jesus didn't say anything at this point. So this is where we have to go to Mark's account, because Mark includes the critical phrase that explains the problem we have here. Mark chapter 14, verse 55. And that should be in your Harmony of the Gospels. It says, "Now the chief priests and all the council sought testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. For many bore false witness against him, but their testimonies did not agree." So they found lots of people willing to give false testimony, but their testimonies didn't agree. And that's a crucial problem when you're trying to condemn someone to death for what they're trying to condemn him to death. So the false witnesses gave testimony, but their testimony was contradictory. They didn't jive together. According to Jewish law, as given in the Torah, a person can be convicted of the particular crime for which they're trying to condemn Christ. How many of you know what crime they're trying to convict Christ of here? What crime are they trying to convict Christ of? Does anybody know? What's that? Trying to convict him of being a blasphemer. All right? And there's a reason for that, as we'll see. So they're trying to convict him of being a blasphemer. And so they're seeking to have witnesses who would attest to that. And the oral law specified that it must be more than just two witnesses who say, "I heard this man commit this crime." So you can't just have a couple of people show up, "Yeah, I heard him say that." "Well, what did he say?" Well, then you check their testimony, and if they don't jive, then you can't use that testimony to condemn him. Their testimony has to agree. In other words, under the oral law, they said, "We have to be careful that we don't condemn somebody improperly," which I'm like, again, are you people, you guys are missing the bigger picture here. False witnesses, and then you're worried about that their testimony agrees. Who cares? Yeah, just don't even worry about those details. But they did. It's not enough just to get a multitude of people to say, yes, I heard him say it. Their testimony has to agree. So as I said, the crime that they're trying to convict him of is blasphemy. Now, does anybody know why they want to convict him of blasphemy? Why go? Didn't he come into town and basically announce that he's the Messiah? Why not convict him of that? He's still dead, isn't he? So why go after the charge of blasphemy? Does anybody have an idea? Yes. What's that? No, that's not the reason. That's true. You know, you blaspheme the Spirit, then it is unforgivable. Well, let's. True. That's part of it. So we'll see what the Scriptures tell us, because they do help us to clarify. And that's right. See, if he's condemned for blasphemy, how could he be the Messiah? The Messiah isn't going to be a blasphemer. That's a fundamental issue. So that helps to answer the question. So their first tactic against Christ to get it condemn him fails. They can't find people whose false witness can holds up in court. And as you look in the text, you find that they're trying to kill him because he's a blasphemer. Because how would he have been executed if he was condemned as a blasphemer? Would he have been crucified? How would they have killed him? They would have stoned him. So that would have thrown off all the prophecies that predicted he would die on the stake. That he would, as it said in Psalm 22, you know, you're going to be crucified by, you're going to be crucified, not stoned. So, do you know in the Scriptures of any other person that you might know of, and that was a blasphemer that was put to death? Can you name one? A blasphemer who was put to death. Yes, Sherry. Who? Stephen. Stephen was condemned for blasphemy, and they felt that what he said was blasphemous, and they stoned him to death. And that's the exact same thing they would have done with Christ if he was a blasphemer. And Christ knew that. And Christ is not going to say anything that's going to cause him to be condemned, as we'll see here. So under the Roman administration, they were allowed to administrate, the Jews were allowed to administrate most of their own laws, and including the laws against blasphemy. The only time that the Romans would get involved in a civil case was when one of the parties was a Roman and insisted on a Roman trial. He made an appeal, and that's what happened with Paul, and that could happen in his case. And when was the other classification when a case had to go to the governor? Yes. That's the gist of it. I mean, the Romans were very unhappy with anybody who was considered a traitor. So if you were seeking to overthrow the Roman government, or you're putting yourself above Caesar or something like that, like was said, then the Romans could put you to death. So whether Jew or Roman, if the case involved treason, it would be heard by the governor. So if you're telling people, I am the Messiah, and I am going to set up my kingdom, well, whose kingdom are you superseding? You're superseding that of Caesar and the Roman government. So the Jewish leadership was initially trying to avoid having to go to the governor. They didn't want to go to the governor. They didn't want to do that because they wanted him convicted of blasphemy, as has been said, because it would undermine his credibility as the Messiah. Because is the Messiah going to be a blasphemer? Don't think so. So if he's blaspheming, no way he's going to be there. Yes, Rich? Yeah, I mean, he was not complimentary, and I'm sure that all of the condemnation that he placed upon them in Matthew chapter 23 is a chapter that where he just gave them the ultimate beatdown. I'm sure they were unhappy with that. And so they were like, this guy's got to go. This guy's got to go. As you look at the fact that they didn't want to take him to Pilate, because as was said, it's going to they couldn't get him for blasphemy, and so they just didn't want to go that route. So they sought false witnesses to pursue the case of blasphemy, but they couldn't prove it. So they couldn't come together to conclude that he's a blasphemer and condemn him in that way. There's another way that they could prove blasphemy, which they tried, and that is out of your own mouth. So what they did is they tried to get Christ to condemn himself. So they're condemning. They sought false witnesses. That didn't work. So they're now trying to get him to blaspheme out of his own mouth. So let's go to Mark chapter 14, verse 61. And this is why the high priest speaks to him in the way that he does and asks him the particular question, because he's trying to get him to speak and condemn himself. Verse 61 says, "And again, the high priest asked him, saying to him, 'Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?'" And as you look at Matthew chapter 26, verse 63, which should be on the same page, it says, "And the high priest answered him and said to him, 'I put you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God.'" So he's putting him on oath. When we combine these two verses, it helps to make it a little bit clearer. It seems that the high priest really said this: "I adjure you by the living God that you tell us whether you be the Christ, the Son of the Blessed. Tell us if you be the Christ, the Son of the Blessed." Now, why does he use the term Son of the Blessed rather than Son of God, as you find in Mark chapter 14? Why does the high priest, this is probably literally what the high priest said, why did he say Son of the Blessed instead of Son of God? Bob? He was writing to the Jews, but you also have the fact that the Jews would not say the name of God. So they didn't want to say the name of God, and this is probably a direct quote from what the high priest said. When you look at the other one, it's what he intended. The Son of God is accurate. Both are accurate. But the Son of the Blessed is a euphemism that was common in the time, so you would not refer to God directly. They would say they did not want to say God's name directly. So it's a euphemism common at that time. So question, what is the importance of "I adjure you by the living God"? What is the importance of that? Well, this is known from legal sources in the Talmud as a formal way of putting a question. You're basically putting someone under oath. And if that person replies, he must reply with the truth. Otherwise, if he says anything which is false, that takes God's name in vain, and he has broken the commandment, he could be condemned as a blasphemer. So the goal was to get him to say something and to not speak the truth and therefore be condemned for blasphemy. So the high priest is in essence insisting that he say, "So help me God." Answer and basically, "So help me God," and tell the truth. And it is a way to try to get Jesus to condemn himself, be condemned out of his own mouth. So up to this point, Jesus had been quiet. He said nothing throughout all the proceedings so far, like the Apostle Peter mentions that he didn't say anything. And if he had kept his mouth shut, they could have done nothing. But he opens his mouth at this point, but notice how he opens it. So Christ, if he had kept his mouth shut, they really couldn't have done anything. But you know what? If they had done nothing, he wouldn't have been executed, and that may have missed the whole point of this. And the point was, he had to die. And he was sent into this world to die. And not that he's trying to make it easy, but he is. He does begin to speak at this point. Matthew 26, verse 64. Jesus speaks out for the first time. Jesus said to him, "It is as you said. Nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven." So as you look at Jesus' response, did he answer the question? He asked him if he was the Son of the Blessed, that is, the Son of God. So did he answer the question? How many of you think he answered the question? He actually did. How many of you think that he answered the question based upon where the high priest was coming from? He didn't. He didn't answer the question that the high priest asked. From our perspective, knowing what we know, he did answer the question. He did say, "I am the Son of God." But from the high priest's perspective, he didn't answer. He didn't say he was the Son of God. And we'll see why here momentarily. Because we understand from our perspective, living now with more information. But from the high priest's perspective in his time, he didn't understand what Christ said that way. To the Jewish leadership, Christ is not saying he's the Son of God. That's not what he's saying in verse 64. He's not saying he's the Messiah. It is as you said. Nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven. Would that describe the Messiah to you? Yes, that's exactly what he's saying, but not to the Jews at that time. So the religious leadership hears this and say, "What's up with this? He's saying he's something completely different than the Messiah." Because, see, one thing that helps us to understand what he's saying is apocalyptic literature. And I know most of you are staying up at night reading apocalyptic literature. Probably not, because it's pretty deep and hard to put together. But apocalyptic literature, that was something that was common between the Testaments. An example of apocalyptic literature would be the book of Daniel. The certain characteristics of the book of Daniel that would fit into that category. And in fact, one of the apocalyptic figures common to that literature is found in the book of Daniel, which we'll mention here in a little bit. From looking at apocalyptic literature, the figure that they understood as the Son of Man was a completely separate individual from the one they understood as the Messiah. Wouldn't we understand that the Son of Man is the Messiah? They didn't understand that. They didn't understand that. From their perspective, the Son of Man was a pre-existent, semi-divine being who existed in heaven. And he would come and save them with the power of God from their enemies. But the Messiah was a completely separate individual. He was to be a human being. He was to come to earth to rally the people of Israel and overthrow the Romans. But he was a man, not the Son of Man, who is a semi-divine being. So that's how they looked at it. The Messiah was to be a human deliverer. So when Christ said, he talks about the Son of Man, the high priest hears that and he's like, "What are you talking about? You're saying you're the Son of Man? The semi-divine being who lives in heaven?" That's how he interpreted what Jesus said. And so when they asked him, "Are you the Christ? Are you the anointed one?" He was asking, "Are you that human Son of David, the promised deliverer?" That's what he wanted to know. And Christ answered, "I am the pre-existent Son of Man," in their way of understanding. So they're all like, what? What's this guy talking about? So we can understand what he's saying, but they didn't understand that the Son of Man and the Messiah are one and the same. He was claiming to be preexistent, at least in their thinking, semi-divine, if not fully divine. And what is Jesus quoting from? Well, one place that he could be quoting from where it mentions the Son of Man. Does anybody know that the Son of Man is mentioned in the book of Daniel? Let's go to Daniel chapter 7, verse 3. Just quickly look there. As you look at Daniel chapter 7, verse 13. I said verse 3, and that's incorrect. Daniel 7, verse 13. It says, I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man. One like the Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven, he came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. So this is a mention of the Son of Man, and Christ was aware of this, and basically that's what he's referring to, is the book of Daniel, where it mentions the Son of Man. Now you'll see other mentions of Son of Man in Ezekiel and other places, but it's talking about a human being. It's not talking about this divine being, the Messiah. So what did he mean when he says power? What did he mean when he says power? If you look at the companion scriptures, such as Luke 22, verse 69, it says, hereafter the Son of Man will sit on the right hand of the power of God. So when it talks about the power, it's talking about the power of God, sitting by the power of God. Mark says, of power. And John doesn't get into this at all. So you see, just as today, Orthodox Jews will never say God's name. They won't say God's name. They won't say Yahweh or Jehovah. They don't say that. Does anybody know what they'll say? They'll say Adonai. Or they'll say Hashem, which means the name. Or if they're writing on a piece of paper that they're going to throw out, they'll write G_D. They won't write out God completely. All right, they won't say the name because they believe that in doing so, they are taking God's name in vain. So it was very common for people to use euphemism for God's name. One well-known euphemism, as I said, was power, the Son of the Blessed. That was a euphemism as well. So what Jesus was doing was using a euphemism of the day for the name of God, which they would understand. They understood what he was saying as far as that portion of his statement. So he had been asked by the high priest to make a statement using God's name. And Jesus knew that no matter what statement he made, they would not believe it. It didn't matter what he said. They weren't going to believe it. Even if it was true, they weren't going to believe it. And if he said, I am the Messiah, the Son of God, they're not going to believe that. That's a blasphemy. How dare you think along those lines? If it was said with the name of God, they would definitely condemn him. But he didn't say it in a way where they could condemn him. He was careful. He was telling the truth, and he said what he said in a way that was very careful. Now, yes? Yeah, that's Mark, but again, he's translating what he said in a way that people would recognize. It's not literally what he said before the high priest, because he wouldn't have said that. But looking at people who were not there, it was something that would clarify it for them. So sometimes in a couple of instances here, you're seeing exactly what is said in the context. And in other places, you're not in that context, but you want them to understand what Christ was saying, which is what happens in Mark. So we may have to have more discussion on the way home. We'll see. But anyway. Sometimes there are those times. You said this, and anybody that speaks, you get the opportunity to have more Bible discussion sometimes on the way home. Or when you're at home. So anyway, so Jesus makes this statement that to the religious leadership was outrageous. When he speaks that he's the Son of Man, it's an outrageous statement. You're semi-divine and you're here in the flesh? Come on, what are you doing? So this was not blasphemy, but it was considered to be outrageous. They would consider it outrageous. They couldn't condemn him for blasphemy, but it was outrageous. And so they couldn't condemn him for blasphemy, even though it was an outrageous statement. Chapter 26, verse 65 of Matthew. It says, then the high priest, as he made this statement about the Son of Man, the high priest tore his clothes, saying, he has spoken blasphemy. What further need do we have of witnesses? Look now, you have heard his blasphemy. What do you think? And even though he says this, we shouldn't understand it in terms of being legally the case. It was blasphemous in terms of being outrageous. He's saying, basically, did you hear what this guy said? This is outrageous. He's even gone beyond claiming to be a human Messiah. He's saying that he's this semi-divine being that exists in heaven as part of what he's saying. And that's why in conclusion they answered, he is worthy of death. He deserves to die. In other words, maybe we've been getting hung up on the idea that perhaps we were railroading an innocent man for the sake of saving the nation. Now we don't have to worry about that. He deserves to die. I mean, they felt somewhat guilty that they're railroading him. Now they're like, look at what he's saying, this outrageous statement. He definitely deserves to go. He's certainly claiming even more than being the Messiah. The point is, if he had indeed committed blasphemy, they would have done what they wanted to in this case, which was to stone him. And the fact that they didn't stone him tells you what? He didn't blaspheme. They had no blasphemous statement to condemn him for. Maybe it was outrageous, but it was not blasphemy. Now, let's go to the fourth crucial event, which is Jesus being brought before the Sanhedrin. Jesus being brought before the Sanhedrin. Let's go to Mark chapter 15, verse 1. Mark chapter 15, verse 1. It says, immediately in the morning, so the night is past and it's morning, the chief priest held a consultation with the elders and scribes and the whole council. Look at the wording. As you look at that, what seems curious about the wording? And it's especially curious if you compare Mark 15:1 with the wording of Mark 14:53 and Mark 26, verse 57. If you compare them side by side, it's interesting what you see. In Mark 14:53, it says, and they led Jesus away to the high priest, and with him were assembled the chief priest, the elders, and the scribes. So you have chief priest, elders, and scribes. And then in Matthew 26, it says, and those who had laid hold of Jesus led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and elders were assembled. And, you know, you look at the comparison, and unless you put them side by side, you really can't see the difference. Mark 26, verse 57, and Mark 14:53 are virtually the same. And then you have Mark 15, verse 1, and it's different. Because it says, normally the term scribes refers to the Pharisaic leadership who are mentioned, the elders, the tribal elders who are another component of the great Sanhedrin besides the priest. And you have the priest, the elders, and the scribes making up the great Sanhedrin. But he goes on to say, and the whole council. So this is seems redundant, but it's not a redundancy. It's intended to tell you that this is the whole group. This is a bigger group. So you had a smaller group at night, and then during the day in the morning, you have a bigger group. You have the chief priest, you have the elders and scribes are present along with the whole council. Everybody is present. So they have the whole council there, everybody, the smaller group and the bigger group. So at night they've had this preliminary hearing. Do we have a case? Can we condemn Christ? Then they come together as a whole in the morning to deliver what they've concluded and decide what they're going to do going forward. So originally they hoped in this preliminary hearing at night to get evidence of blasphemy, and they didn't get that. But they did get the outrageous statement about being the Son of Man, didn't they? So then they say, okay, we've got this, and he does deserve to die. So, but we don't have anything that would allow us to take him out and stone him. And even if we can't take him out and stone him, we have evidence that allows us to at least take him to Caesar. So they've come to the great Sanhedrin and decide what they're going to do. How should we proceed? So in Mark 15, verse 1, by Mark's own account, the people who are gathered at night are this little group, and in the morning they assemble with their evidence before the whole group. And they deliberate, and they decide to take him to Pilate. But we don't know what was said. But obviously they couldn't condemn him for blasphemy, so the only option was to take him to Pilate. That's not what we want to do, but that's what we're going to do. So they take the next action is to go to Pilate. So they do not, as they go to Pilate, they don't accuse him of blasphemy, do they? They don't accuse him of blasphemy as the chief charge. Because if they had taken the charge of blasphemy to Pilate, what would Pilate have said? He said, you can't bring this case before me. I have nothing to do with this. You guys try this. You guys, this is your problem. No, don't bring it over here. So he didn't want that case brought to him of blasphemy. So they don't charge him for blasphemy. So let's go to Luke 23, verse 1. Luke 23, verse 1. It says, "Then the whole multitude of them arose and led him to Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, 'We found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ, a king.'" Now, this is the accusation they made. So is the accusation accurate in as they accuse Christ? Is it an accurate accusation? What's accurate about it? He's accurate. It's accurate to the extent that he's come out as the Messiah. But did he forbid them to pay taxes? No. They tried to catch him on that, remember? And what did he say? Whose picture's on the money? If he's on the money, then pay him what he's due. Pay your taxes. So they couldn't get him on the tax issue. But that he had come across as the Messiah, clearly he had, even though he had not said so verbally. But coming into town, riding on the donkey, he was making a public declaration. And it was time to make that declaration. Now let's go to John chapter 18, where John tells us about this. John 18, beginning in verse 28. John 18, verse 28. It says, "Then they led Jesus from Caiaphas to the praetorium, and it was early morning. But they themselves did not go into the praetorium, lest they should be defiled, but they might eat, that they might eat the Passover." And to me, these guys aren't defiled already by the stuff they've been doing? And they're worried about going in there and being defiled so they can't take the Passover? To me, again, this is just me maybe, but seems kind of funny. Why are you worried about this? You are defiled. What's a little more defiling going to do? Just go ahead and get completely defiled and go ahead and eat the Passover. But that was their mindset. Pilate then went out to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" In other words, this is a Jewish man, and you are Jewish leadership. Normally you judge these things in your own court. Why are you bringing this matter to our attention? Chapter 18, verse 30. They answered him, and they answered and said to him, "If he were not an evildoer, we would not have delivered him up to you." So does that seem respectful? Does that seem respectful to Pilate? In actuality, it's not. They're saying, look, we wouldn't have brought him up to you if he wasn't an evildoer. It's disrespectful. And it tells you something about the relation between the Jewish leadership and Pilate. There are problems here. And one person termed the approach they have toward Pilate as cheeky. Cheeky. Does everybody know what cheeky is? You're flippant, disrespectful, and that's the approach that they have. Cheeky. I never grew up with cheeky, but I remember one individual using that term. So John is expressing the tenor of their answer. They're being disrespectful and somewhat cheeky with Pilate. Keep that in mind, because as we get to the final sermon on this, we'll answer why that was the case. Chapter 18 of John, verse 31. Then Pilate said to them, "You take him and judge him according to your law. You have courts. You have the right to bring judgment. Why are you bringing this man to me?" But it's interesting what they say here in John 18, verse 31. Therefore, they said, the Jews said to him, "It is not lawful for us to put anyone to death." Is that true? Who could they put to death? Blasphemers. They could put blasphemers to death. But could they put someone to death for treason? They couldn't. And they're accusing Jesus of treason, and they can't put him to death for that. So you have to look at that. It is not lawful for us to put anyone to death for treason. That's the point they're making. It's not that they couldn't put someone to death. Verse 32, that the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled which he spoke, signifying by what death he would die. Because anyone that was accused of treason would be executed by crucifixion. Verse 33, then Pilate entered the praetorium again, called Jesus and said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" A specific statement. And he's saying, in other words, are you the Messiah? Do you claim to be the Messiah? Are you guilty as charged? And what does Jesus say? Verse 34. Jesus answered him, "Are you speaking for yourself about this? Or did others tell you this concerning me?" You know, from a Roman standpoint, they weren't worried about Messiahs and all that, except as it had an impact on their rule. But that's not something they were looking forward to and concerned about. So, and then verse 35, Pilate said, "Am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priest have delivered you to me. What have you done?" And Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight, so that I would not be delivered to the Jews. But now my kingdom is not from here. My servants aren't going to fight. I'm not raising an army. I'm not seeking the overthrow of the Roman government at this time. I'm not doing any of that." And Pilate's mystified by that, because this is not the normal insurrectionist rebel that he's used to. Most of the people he's come into contact with they hate the Roman government. They want the overthrow of the Roman government. They want to raise an army. They want to take the Romans on. And here's this guy saying, "Yes, I am a king, but I have no intention of overthrowing the Roman government." So he's a little bit taken aback by that, because that's not what he was expecting. It wasn't how most people claiming to be the Messiah would come across. So this isn't my time. There will come a day when I will come with an army, but this isn't it. So you don't have to worry about that. So Pilate really doesn't understand what's going on. And there's a lengthy interrogation that goes on, but, you know, it's really a little bit over his head. So Pilate comes back out to the Jewish leadership, and he says, which we have in Luke's account in Luke chapter 23. Let's look over there. And he says to the chief priests and the multitudes that have gathered in the courtyard, He said, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And he answered him, Pilate asked him, saying, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And he answered him and said, "It is as you say." So Pilate said to the chief priest and the crowd, "I find no fault in this man. I don't see any reason to condemn him. I don't see that he's guilty of the charge that you're bringing." He said, "Normally, the guy that is before me, he wants to overthrow the Roman government, and this isn't that guy. He's making no such claims. And I don't understand why you brought him to me." But what was the response of the leadership? It says in verse 5, "But they were the more fierce, saying, 'He stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Judea, beginning from Galilee to this place.'" This guy's stirring up people all over Judea and on up into Galilee. And the only word that Pilate heard out of all of that was Galilee. And he thought, jackpot. I don't want to deal with this guy. I don't see any reason to condemn him. So I can pass this hot potato off to my friend Herod Antipas. So he sends him to Herod. And Herod interrogates him. And Christ didn't say anything. He's asking him questions and he didn't say anything. So, and the priest went with him and they vehemently accused him. And Herod Antipas at this particular time was in Jerusalem, so all he had to do was travel across town to where Herod was, and then they could put him before Herod. So all they did was array him in a gorgeous robe and mock him and humiliate him. And then they sent him back to Pilate. So I'm sure when they showed up with Jesus, Pilate thought, "Oh no, here we go again." But he didn't want him back, but here he comes. So as you read through this in the harmony, you will see that Pilate seems to continue to find no reason to condemn Jesus. And he tries to placate the Jewish leadership and not condemn him, as we'll see. But there are several serious things in the account which we'll look at next time. One, maybe you've never noticed this before, but as I said, Jesus ends up being scourged twice. He's scourged on two different occasions. Why is he scourged twice? There's a reason for that. And as you look at the scriptures, you'll find that that is the case. Why is it that Pilate caves in and agrees to condemn a man he believes to be innocent? Why does he eventually cave? Does it have to do with why the Jewish leadership was so cheeky in their approach to him? And three, also, you will find other incidents of this cheeky attitude on the part of the leaders of Judea that they're showing to Pilate. They are certainly not treating him with respect. And there's a reason for that, as we'll see. And as that is pressed, Pilate eventually caves. So we'll look at the final portion of Jesus' trial and condemnation, and we'll look at his death and note a few things about that as we conclude this subject. So I thought this would be helpful to you. You say, "Man, this is a lot of history, more history than I ever wanted." But it's sometimes good to take a look at what transpires there so you understand who and what and where and why. And it can be clear in your mind as you know some of those things. So thank you for your attention. Sometimes that's a difficult thing. Thankfully, I didn't see too much of this. But anyway, you know what's bad? When people are just leaning their heads back and all you see are nostrils. So there wasn't too much of that, thankfully. So thank you for your attention. Please have a wonderful remainder of the Sabbath and a good week ahead. And we'll see you next Sabbath.